device extends life.
Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome.
Expands consciousness.
To X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Remember, this is where the past meets the future. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or working on your favorite project, you're about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. You might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with me. Lots going on. Too much to talk about in just 3 hours. It's got to be webcast radio's shortest 3 hours out there. Glad you're here on the BBS Radio Network, the largest webcast radio network in North America, possibly in the world. You're in the right place to learn about what's going on and why. The solar wind is a brisk 387.5 kilometers per second, and the proton count is up to 2.2. Be careful out there. Wear sunscreen. Remember, every sunburn you get increases your risk of skin cancer logarithmically. There are 6 giant sunspot clusters facing Earth today. We don't call them sunspots anymore because these things are huge. They're multiples of Earth's diameter, and they're scattered. They're like shotgun blasts in the surface of the sun. An interplanetary shockwave, possibly associated with the M5 class solar flare of May 17th, about 3 days ago, swept past Earth today. The shockwave's arrival caused geomagnetic activity around the poles and several outbreaks of high-latitude auroras. And there's a lot going on the sun. You know, we're nearing the solar maximum of 2013. Many people are anxious about that. Also, there is an annular solar eclipse today. We won't see it on the East Coast. But in about 3 hours, you'll be able to see it on the West Coast just before sundown. Thousands of people are planning viewing parties for the upcoming eclipse. It's a rare event in which the sun will appear as a thin ring behind the moon. The eclipse will begin over Asia on Monday, which is today, when it will be visible in southern Japan and southern China. In the United States, the eclipse will be visible on a path from northwestern Texas through New Mexico, northeastern Arizona, southern Utah, Nevada, northern California, and southwestern Oregon late Sunday. We won't get to see it here on the East Coast. Be careful how you look at it. Don't stare at it with your eyes. Remember the story we just ran about the woman who was trying to live on sunlight alone, she starved to death. I recommend anyone who has a chance to see this, do it. Because while they do occasionally happen very rarely, it is a neat thing to see. And you can use a pair of binoculars, aim it at a piece of paper on the ground, and you can look at the shadow. Or you can, of course, use a coronoscope. That's the desired way, but not everybody has a coronoscope. In the H+ bandwidth, it will be spectacular because you'll be seeing it in color and live. It's not like a photograph. It'll really take your breath away. During an annular eclipse, the moon does not block the entirety of the sun, but leaves a bright ring of visible light at the edges, according to NASA. For the May eclipse, the moon will be at the furthest distance from Earth that it ever achieves, meaning that it will block the smallest possible portion of the sun and leave the largest possible bright ring around the outside. The last annular eclipse appeared in the United States in 1994. The next solar eclipse will be on November 13th, and it is expected to be visible over northern Australia. We won't even get to see it here in the U.S. In western United States, more than 1,000 people may flood the small town of Canaraville, Utah, population 300, to get the best views of Sunday's event. The town is called the Eclipse as it's calling the eclipse the Ring of Fire. The Bryan Head Resort in Utah is very high up. It's a ski resort, still open. You can take the tram up to the top of the mountain peak at 11,000 feet for $8. And you can watch it from there with provided solar glasses. Could be quite a trip if you're near there. Also, coming up very soon on June 5th and June 6th, depending on where you are on the planet, there is a Venus transit. Now, many of you know what that is, but some of you don't. This is where Venus, you know, is between us and the sun, or its orbit is between us and the sun. This is where Venus crosses in front of the sun, viewable by Earth. It doesn't happen very often. It's a rare event. It'll take place on June 5th for the Western Hemisphere observers. It'll be June 6th in the Eastern Hemisphere. It's over a seven-hour span. It takes about 7 hours for the sun, or for Venus, to cross the disk of the sun. It's Earth's sister planet. Will trek across the solar disk from our perspective. Appearing in silhouette is a slow-moving, tiny black dot. You can see it with the naked eye, but again, use proper viewing apparel. Venus transit occur in pairs that are 8 years apart, but these dual events take place less than once per century. The last one occurred in 2004, and the next one won't come until 2117. For the Mayan world, the planet Venus has been one of the most predominant celestial phenomenon, as well as one which entire centuries of observation have been dedicated. It can almost be said that the ancestral Mayan wise men had an obsession with Venus. The earliest written accounts on this subject are found in the first pages of the sacred book of the Mayan Quiche nation, the Popol Vuh, which we also quoted in the Ark of Millions of Years series. It describes how Hukub Kazik, or Kakiz, one of the original names for Venus, tried to take over the place of the father sun. The fascination of scientists and mystics has been limited because of, you know, few of them know the real meaning of the context of this extraordinary document. Regarding the synodic phases, cycles, and transit of Venus, it only confirmed the close attention that the Mayan world had over this planet. Interesting that although they were considered a primitive people, they were highly accomplished astronomers and engineers. The apparent path of Venus over the face of the father sun, an ecliptic transit in relation to the sun, has announced drastic changes in the earth from cataclysms, wars, destruction, lack of food, plagues, etc., to historical changes regarding the evolutionary development of both human beings and the mother earth, a destiny that is connected, although not intertwined. Some have said that you know, death is knocking on our door. We're going to have our second of our eight-year Venus transits, one in 2004, this one in 2012. Others have said that a new evolution in human consciousness is about to crest. And still others have said that nothing at all will happen. It's all too easy to go back through astronomical timelines and correlate disasters with months that Venus transited the sun. But there have been plenty of cataclysms that took place with Venus was far away from this alignment. I, for one, do not put much into the alignment of Venus with the Earth and the Sun, but you never know. The best thing to do is to be prepared. The first telescopic record was on a Sunday in 1639 by young Jeremiah Horath. He recorded it in a drawing. And then again in the 17th century, a fleet of observers was sent out across the globe by ships to record the transit in order to measure the size of the solar system. It was quite brilliant. It was done again in the 18th and 19th centuries with precision to the second. Billions around the world were able to witness the celestial alignment in 2004, which has only been recorded in human history six times before. We don't really have the Mayan astronomical records, but we do have their fascination with Venus going back to the 5th century BC. We recorded it in 1631, 1639, then again in 1761 and 1769, then in 1874 and 1882, and of course our last transit, as I said, was in 2004, and satellites recorded it. Won't happen again in your lifetime. So I would get out there and get a smoky piece of glass or go to your local observatory or planetarium and take a peek. It'll be one of those events of a lifetime. So does Earth change during this transit? That's a good question. There are some speculations with actually very little correlative fact to go with it. But there are strong opinions. This is also clear evidence that we are nearing the galactic plane of gravity that will have an effect on the planetary stability of all planets in our solar system. Right now, the only one we really care about is Earth. You will recall, if you read the Arc of Millions of Years series, that the grand sextile alignment occurred in 2004, and it's on the cover of the book. It happened only once, heralding the birth of King Solomon, and it was prophesied it would occur again when the keys to understanding the creation were restored. That's why we put it on the cover of the book. So if you want to be part of tonight's program, we'll talk about some interesting stuff like this and other things, I encourage you to do so. Our toll-free number is 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. You can also listen by conference line. It's a kind of a unique way to listen. You can dial 760-569-7676 and then the passcode 192-919-pound. And you can listen to the show, although you can't interact with it. You can also go to xsquaredradio.com if you have a Droid phone, and you can download the Droid app. That way all you have to do is click on that and you're right into BBS Radio Channel 2. If you do that at this time on Sunday evening, you'll be listening to X Squared Radio. A couple of announcements now that the time is right. Excuse me while I take a sip of my grapefruit juice. Several hundred of you have clicked on the Maya 2012 link. If you go to xsquaredradio.com, it is the orange link in the affiliates side, there where the banners are. And it says Maya 2012. You click on that, it will take you to the conference that begins on the 19th of December and will take us to the 22nd. I'm sorry, did I have that right? Something like that. Anyway, I promise to have you home by Christmas. We meet up in Houston. If you can get yourself to Houston, you can save a little bit of money. The cost of the entire conference is covered from Houston to Chichen Itza, which is in the Yucatan. We will be at Ground Zero for 2012. This is where Pakal's famous tomb lid was found and where the revelations about what would happen in 2012 were originated and recorded in stone and discovered in 1958. You really want to have some stories to tell your kids and grandkids when they ask you, where were you on December 21st, 2012? You can tell them you were at Ground Zero. You were with some of the best speakers and documentarians in the world on this subject. And it's with Power Places Tour, so you know it's going to be a very high-quality event, a fantastic venue. If you don't have a passport, if you don't want to travel internationally, or you can't see yourself affording that kind of trip, then we have another one for you in October. It's called the Pythagoras Conference. It's easy to get to. It's in southern Indiana at a very fine resort. It's very affordable. You click on the banner at xsquaredradio.com, pythagorasconference.com. You'll not only get $100 off, but you can see the entire itinerary. 50 of some of the world's best speakers are going to be there, including dignitaries and royalty from other countries. And this one is within driving distance of 75% of the nation. So you don't have to fly. You don't have to have a passport. and you can afford this one because we're giving you $100 off. PythagorasConference.com. On the 24th of June, my good friend and colleague, Dr. Amit Goswami, professor emeritus in physics, is going to come on the program and talk about his new book. I am receiving it in the mail this week. I will read it, and we'll talk about it in brief a couple of times, and you can get ready for the interview. He's a good man. He has really turned the science of physics on its head by asserting that consciousness is involved in the creation of matter. And believe it or not, most of the physicists that I know, both inside and outside the government, are tending to agree, because there are things about quantum physics that are inexplicable unless you involve the interaction of some sort of intelligence, which may or may as well be consciousness. So one of the things that's very hot in the news right now, and we'll get to the political science, economic science, and that later, but one of the things I want to talk about in this hour is the solar maximum that we are nearing. A lot of people don't know what that means. I mean, they kind of hear it, but they think it's, you know, something elusive. It is something measurable. Every 11 years, the north and south poles of the sun change places. The poles of the sun rotate. And during this rotation, the sun puts out a tremendous pulse during the solar maximum. And the pulse can be high frequency, can be low frequency, can be gravitational, it can be particles, it can be waves. But the effect on Earth is at times quite devastating. You remember the Carrington event in 1859, we were just barely becoming an electric society. We had telegraph wires strung up between major cities along railroads across our country, which operated off of DC voltage and a coil, like an electromagnet. So you could click voltage on one side and it would energize an electromagnet on the other end, and it would click a tappet. And Morse code was developed so that letters and numbers could be transmitted across those wires, and those that understood the code could send and receive and deliver those telegrams. Well, one other thing that those wires made good for was they made great solar antennas. When the solar maximum happened in 1859 and the massive flare occurred, it dumped literally hundreds of billions of electron volts toward the Earth. Well, the only thing that we really had that resembled wires were railroad tracks and telegraph wires. And so the telegraph wires picked up that voltage, transmitted it to both ends, caught several telegraph offices on fire, resulting in injury and fatalities, and it was some weeks before the system came back up again. That was the extent of our electronic society in 1859. Here in 2012, it's a little different story. Everything from phones to pads to laptops to cars to health equipment, everything from the fresh bread we have in our grocery store to the gasoline we pump into the tanks of our vehicles is all regulated, powered, and measured by microelectronics. And not just the microelectronics, it's also the macroelectronics. You drive by them from time to time, the big substations in your neighborhood or down the street. These are collections of what we call step-down transformers. Usually they're 13.8 kilovolt. They take the 100,000 volts that's on the power lines, step it down to 4160. That goes out to regional transformers at substations. It breaks it down to 440, and then 220 comes to your home and splits into 220 and 110. The higher voltage allows them to use smaller wire and transmit over longer distances, which works fine because we're going from the high voltage generated at the power plant to low voltage at your house. But like 1859, all those wires hanging in the sky, both the high tension and low tension lines, are all good solar antennas. They'll pick up the voltage of a giant solar flare, and they will transmit it to both sides of those step-down transformers. So whereas we're stepping down from 8 to 1, stepping down from 100,000 volts to around 13,000 volts, it will also step up. If the voltage comes in on the secondary side, it will jump the transformer and be amplified 8 times and be put onto the high tension lines. So instead of 100,000 volts, it'd be 100 million volts on aluminum wire that's stretched for hundreds and hundreds of miles across this country. The aluminum wire will explode. And if it doesn't explode, the transformer will melt down. You know how many spare transformers we have around the country? That's right. None. And the transformer companies that make the transformers, they run on electricity. So you can see the fix will be in. If we have a Carrington event magnitude of a geomagnetic storm from the sun, and it does result in the meltdown of several regional transformers or power stations, it will be some time before we're able to do much else than rub two sticks together to make fire. Many disruptions and adaptations will occur in society. I'm not the only one talking about this. The National Space Weather Program Council is organizing the next Space Weather Enterprise Forum. It's scheduled for June 5th, a little over 2 weeks from now. The National Press Club in Washington, D.C. If you're near there, you can go, because the theme is the Solar Maximum 2013, how space weather will affect you. Now, the NSWP, the National Space Weather Program Council, is part of the U.S. Federal Meteorological Coordinating Infrastructure under the Office of the Federal Coordinator for Meteorological Services and Supporting Research. The council brings together the federal agencies involved with providing space weather products and services, space weather research, users of space weather information, and other offices that set policy or funding for the space weather enterprise. The purpose is to facilitate coordination, collaboration, and leveraging of activities, results, and capabilities across the federal agencies. Now, you know my fondness for the agency government. So they're all going to be there. Excuse me. Because there's going to be money handed out. As we approach the next peak of solar activity, which can happen any day, and it's really expected in 2013. If we make it past the winter of 2013, we're pretty much home free. Our nation faces multiplying uncertainties from increasing reliance on space weather-affected technologies for communications, navigation, GPS and other, security, and other activities, many of which underpin our national infrastructure and economy. We already talked about the flow of food, the flow of energy, fuel, traffic control, internet. We also faced increased exposure to space weather-driven human health risks as transpolar flights and space activities. So if you're planning any spacewalks anytime soon, you might want to listen up. Over the years, the annual Space Weather Enterprise Forums have gathered a wide range of stakeholders, including providers, users, and researchers from government, academia, and the private sector, as well as legislators and staff from Capitol Hill, to raise awareness and share information on space weather. This year, we will continue this outreach, but we'll sharpen the focus on two aspects of our nation's critical infrastructure: electrical power distribution networks, and precision navigation and timing provided by global navigation satellite systems. The odds of something like this taking us by surprise, because the sun is, 93 million miles away, are pretty slim, but that doesn't mean that it won't disrupt things. One way out of it would be to power down. Shut down the substations, open the bus bars, let the transformers just sit there unconnected on the primary and secondary sides, In fact, you could put shorting bars together so that that they're neutral. They can't even build up a charge, not the capacitors, power factor capacitors, and others. But it takes some work. It takes some coordination because there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of substations and dozens of power stations all around the country. It will take a coordinated effort. If the CME is normal velocity, it's about 73 hours warning we have. If it's high velocity, you can cut that in half, about 35 hours, just a little over 24 hours. That's how fast your utility companies will have to respond, and they will have to rehearse. And that's what the funding is going to be for. Now, as I told you, this forum is coming up. It is coming up very soon, session one. The forum opens with remarks from Mr. Samuel P. Williamson, the federal coordinator for meteorology and chairman of the National Space Weather Program, followed by keynote presentations from congressional and senior administration leaders, which will mostly be a bunch of political crap that you can just toss in the round file. They just want to know how it'll get them reelected. In session two, what space weather is and why it matters. This is an important one. If you're in the D.C. area, you can go to the National Press Club. I'll give you the location here in a little bit, and you can attend. As we enter into a period of increased activity, this session will describe the nature of space weather and how it affects us in our daily lives. The panelists will highlight recent spectacular solar events and their impact on the Earth and our vulnerable critical technical infrastructure. This is good. This is really good. The civilian side, my colleagues, have made their case before Congress, and we have alerted them, and now they are at least putting together this forum. The third session is critical infrastructure protection, mitigation, and response. As I said, getting areas ready to respond to a giant flare so that we can reduce the amount of long-term damage. Session four is the Unified National Space Weather Capability. This basically is coordinating the agencies that are developing to achieve maximum efficiency and effectiveness of our space weather services to the nation. That's a fancy way of saying create the most possible jobs for the amount of money that's been granted. I have in the past seen nothing but academics fill this up. You're not going to see very many industry specialists. Nobody from Avista, PG&E, Duke Power. You know, these are the kinds of people that need to head up these. They know what kind of equipment they have. They know what their safeties are. They know what their risks are. They're the ones that have the money on the line, and they're the ones that should be involved in these agencies, not bureaucrats. Session five is responding to new and emerging extreme events. This session will examine the challenges and opportunities in raising awareness and understanding of space weather impacts on daily life, security, the global economy, infrastructure, and business continuity. One of the things that we realize as we watched this happen last year is that South Africa was hit, and it knocked their power out. And not too long ago, the Canada was hit and wiped its power out. It did recover, but these attacks, so to speak, were regional. That is to say, it didn't cover the whole globe. So we have a tendency to look at this as a point of vulnerability in case, you know, it hits us and doesn't hit our neighbors too. So if it does hit us and not our neighbors, then we're vulnerable. And that's really what it boils down to. A giant explosion of energy from the sun, it could paralyze Earth in just 3 years' time. And that's what scientists warned, and this was just yesterday. The fear of a huge solar flare is due to erupt in 2013, causing blackouts and global chaos. Not really been a problem in human history until now. 11 years ago, it was 2001. We didn't have smartphones. We didn't have tablets. We had laptops, but, you know, that wasn't really our lifestyle. We'd only had high-speed internet for 5 years. It has since changed everything. We move money through ACH, that's Automated Clearinghouse. We have all kinds of asset-based collateralization that goes on real-time by the web. We have a USGS grid. We have a GPS grid. All of these things tied together by very, very sensitive electronics. The once-in-a-century disaster could see power grids crash, communication systems collapse, planes grounded, food supplies hit, and, yes, even the internet shut down. Everything from home freezers to car satellite systems, cell phones, smart pads, laptops, pacemakers, transistor radios, everything. The threat of another disaster, which could mirror scenes in Hollywood's blockbuster 2012, is so great that Defense Secretary Liam Fox called an emergency conference in London yesterday. Dr. Fox told experts that an incalculable damage would be caused if an explosion similar to the one in 1859 occurred in modern times in Europe or the UK. He called on scientists to build a strategy against the impending disaster. The talks, organized by the Electric Infrastructure Security Council, heard that the sun will reach a critical stage of its cycle in 2013. And hopefully, not like most government programs where they are ready, shoot, aim, they will put together a coordinated effort with private sector scientists and engineers so that they know where to spend the money and know what to do and care less about their bloody re-elections. A surge of magnetic energy in the upper atmosphere is likely to trigger radiation storms, which cause massive power surges. Such a phenomenon occurs only about once every 100 years. We are overdue, because the last one, as I told you, was in 1859. That one smothered two-thirds of the Earth's skies in a blood-red aura, and such scenes could occur again. In cities like London, Paris, New York, Shanghai, city of 30 million people, Beijing, Moscow. In 1989, a more common, smaller flare took out the power stations in Quebec, Canada. You remember that? And that's what sort of gave Enron its chance to make inhuman profits off of brokering power. Yesterday's conference also heard that a hostile power could cause a similar effect by exploding a nuclear weapon in space. We talked about that as well. Air Force briefings, which I personally declassified so that you will know what our strategy was during MAD, how long it would take for the first strike to occur, and what would be the results. Dr. Fox added, while we all benefit from scientific advances, we also create vulnerabilities that can be exploited by our enemies. Of course, our enemies have just as much a chance of being wiped out the same way. And, of course, they will protect themselves as well. However advanced we become, at least electronically, the chain of our security is only as strong as the weakest circuit. Last night, the Electric Security Council discussed a plan of action. I do not have that plan at my disposal. But I do have eminent expert, fellow physicist and colleague, Dr. Michio Kaku, ready to explain this. And
should we be worried about increasing solar activity? Michio Kaku is here with one of, he's obviously the professor. We all know him, a theoretical physics. He's also the host of the sci-fi science show on the Science Channel, which is based on his book, Physics of the Impossible. Professor, should we be worried about these flare-ups? When talking about this morning, we all kind of agreed, it has that Y2K feeling, like it could happen. But if it doesn't, we're going to spend a lot of money for nothing.
Well, we had a wake-up call just 2 weeks ago. Giant auroras, northern lights as far as Michigan and Wisconsin. And that's a warm-up for 2012-2013 when we hit the sunspot cycle. Every 11 years, the North Pole and the South Pole of the sun flip, releasing a burst of radiation. But every 100 years or so, a monster tsunami from the sun emerges, which could literally cause trillions of dollars in property damage.
2012, that's a presidential election year. We need to keep that in mind. But if I'm walking around out there, yeah, as to whose fault it is, or at least the history, who they'll blame. So if I'm walking around, if I'm out sunbathing in a Speedo, will I look like Charles after about 5 minutes out there? Color, anyways. Obviously, I'm not going to look like Charles in a Speedo, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, is it going to really affect us like that?
I just went from bad to worse.
It could paralyze the economy of the planet Earth.
But not from a physical perspective.
Physical perspective, yeah. 1859, we had a gigantic solar storm which knocked out telegraph wires back then, 150 years ago. Yeah. If that had happened today, it would knock out almost all our satellites, knock out power stations. There would be food riots around the country because refrigeration would stop. Airplanes would probably crash without radar. It would paralyze the planet Earth. $2 trillion in property damage. And again, this is a once-in-a-century, once-in-two-century storm. The last one was 1859. But we do have them, and we have to worry about them.
That's a pretty high probability, once in two centuries.
Do we get a warning? I mean, is it like, hey, in 2 hours this happens, in 2 days this happens, in 2 weeks this happens? I mean, if the flare takes place, what kind of warning will we have to go to the other side of the Earth?
And who do you sue?
I'll figure that out. I got that one.
Mark can tell you that later.
I got that covered, okay?
This is an act of God.
Oh, yeah. By the way, Michio, you might want to sign a waiver before you leave because Mark has you on his list already.
You have now put corporate America on notice. They are responsible for taking preparations. Go ahead, sir.
We have virtually no warning. It's like a giant earthquake. You can't predict giant earthquakes. They happen on a scale of once every 100, 200 years. That's what we have to worry about. We physicists have been telling Congress we have to reinforce our power stations. We have to have redundancy in our telecommunication systems, our satellites. Several of our satellites apparently have already been knocked out or at least disrupted because of solar flares. The space station has to worry about solar flares. But a giant one, like I said, could wipe out power stations on the Earth, wipe out communications, the internet, radar, airplane travel. It would be a mess. We'd be thrown back 100 years.
But are any steps being taken to, if God forbid this happens?
In Congress, there is a bill to pass a paltry $100 million. It's stalled in Congress right now. It's an insurance policy. It would cost very little to begin the process of reinforcing our transformers, power stations. And remember, this does happen even periodically. In 2003 in South Africa, 14 power stations were wiped out because a solar flare hit South Africa. In Canada, the city of Quebec was partially paralyzed, again, about 10, 15 years ago because of a solar flare. These things happen, but the monster one is the one that we physicists are worried about.
Okay, so now you have Michio Kaku talking about it. It is real, and it's not as though we don't have any warning. As I said, we have 6 sunspot clusters on the sun right now. Last week and a half, we went through 1476, which was an amazing triple-barreled shotgun that was aimed right at Earth. It did flare. One of them went out into space toward Mars. And the other one just glanced off of Earth and caused some high-latitude auroras. Right now, there are 6 triple-barreled shotguns aimed at the Earth, and all of them harbor what could be M or even X-class flares. But interestingly enough, we're now able to track magnetic filaments that tie these flares, these sunspots together. And these filaments are hundreds of thousands of miles long. And they're sort of like giant magnetic rubber bands. And when they snap, they literally lash out into space like a whip, throwing very high energy particles out into space. That's different than a solar flare. Anyway, if you're interested in learning about the $100 million that's stalled in Congress, what the agencies are going to try to do, and I really implore you that if you're in that area, please go check on them and see what they're talking about, see what they're doing. Give me a call, write me an email, tell me about it, because You know and I know government uses these kinds of events, whether it's global warming or whether it's sea levels rising or whether it's holes in the ozone layer or whatever, to overreach with its power and even create new agency regulations or new agencies altogether. The forum is on June 5th. It's the Space Weather Enterprise Forum. It will be held at the National Press Club. If you don't know where that is, it's 529 14th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C. You just set your GPS and drive to it. It's not hard to find. The forum will meet in the ballroom on the 13th floor, and the closing reception will be in the First Amendment room, also on the 13th floor. Kind of interesting that a building would have 13 floors. When I was growing up, you jumped from the 12th floor to the 14th floor. There was no 13 on the elevator buttons. You remember that? Yeah, exactly. There, you never had a 13. Who wanted to live on a 13th floor? We were such a, and still are probably, a superstitious nation. Well, there are other interesting things going on. I recently saw a very interesting documentary about a drug. This is a drug that fortunately does not get out much, but it is only used for skullduggery. It is not used for recreation. It is the most dangerous drug in the world. It is called the Devil's Breath. It's a chemical from Colombia in Bogota. And it can block free will. It can wipe out your memory, and it can even kill you. You can overdose on it very easily. A hazardous drug that eliminates free will and can wipe the memory of its victims is currently being dealt on the streets of Colombia. The drug's official name is scopolamine, but it is colloquially known as the Devil's Breath, and is derived from a particular type of tree common to South America. Beautiful flower, by the way. The stories surrounding the drug are the stuff of urban legends, with some telling horror stories of how people were raped. That's quite common. Forced to empty their bank accounts willingly. Even coerced to giving up an organ. They wake up in a bathtub with a note that says you have, 4 hours to get to a hospital. And I don't mean forced to empty their bank accounts. I mean they're just asked to empty their bank accounts, and people are picked up on the bank camera going there and literally getting as much money as they can get out with their ATM card and handing it over to someone who is ordering them around that has given them scopolamine. The documentary was for adult viewing only. It's quite violent. Vice's Ryan Duffy traveled to the country to find out more about the powerful drug. In two segments of this documentary, he revealed the shocking culture of another Colombian drug world, interviewing those who deal the drug and those who have fallen victim to it. Demencia Black, a drug dealer in the capital of Bogota, said the drug is frightening for the simplicity in which it can be administered. You simply blow it into the face of a passerby on the street, and within minutes that person is under the drug's effect. Scopolamine is odorless and tasteless. You can guide them wherever you want, he explained. It's like they're a child. Black said that 1 gram of scopolamine is similar to a gram of cocaine, but it's worse than anthrax. In high doses, it is lethal. The drug turns people into complete zombies and blocks memories from forming. So even after the drug wears off, victims have no recollection as to what happened. One victim told Vice that a man approached her on the street asking her for directions, just simple directions. Since it was close by, she helped take the man to his destination, and they drank juice together. She ended up taking the man to her house and helped him gather all her belongings, including her boyfriend's cameras and his savings that he had stashed away. The woman said it's painful to have lost money, but I was actually quite lucky. According to the British Journal of Clinical Pharmacology, the drug also known as hyoscine causes the same level of memory loss as diazepam. In ancient times, the drug was given to the mistresses of dead Colombian leaders. They were told to enter their master's grave, where they were buried alive. In modern times, the CIA used the drug as part of the Cold War interrogations, with the hope of using it like a truth serum. However, because of the drug's chemical makeup, it also induces powerful hallucinations. The tree common around Colombia is called the Barachero tree, or Borrachero tree, loosely translated as the get-you-drunk tree. It is said that Colombian mothers warn their children not to fall asleep under the tree, though the leafy green canopies and large yellow and white flowers seem appealing. Experts are baffled as to why Colombia is riddled with scopolamine-related crimes, but wager much of it has to do with the country's torn drug culture past and an ongoing civil war. Terrible, terrible stuff going on out there. I guess I have enough time to cover this. There's a treaty called the Sea Treaty, you know, like S-E-A, like ocean. And there's a push to ratify this treaty in the UN. And there are many who believe that ratifying this would cause our sovereignty to be lost forever. So, you know, this is just more of the same, but only better. This is a couple of days ago. So here we go again. The usual suspects, the environmentalist, the one-worlder transnationalist, the Obama administration, to the extent that it is not redundant, and assorted short-sighted special interests, including, regrettably, the United States Navy, are dusting off the hopelessly outdated and inequitable UN law of the Sea Treaty, better and more accurately known as LOST, like Lost at Sea, in the hope of jamming its ratification through the Senate, as was done 2 years ago with the defective New START Treaty. You know, that's the Strategic Missile Treaty. Amazingly, they're doing so under what intelligence professionals would dub a false flag operation. We've talked about those many times on this program. They wave the flag of crisis, of disaster, of threat, of terrible things going to happen. The public says, oh, we can't let that happen. We must give up more of our security. And so the Senate does what they do. Anyway, it's an initiative that presents itself as one thing, in this case, the American Sovereignty Campaign, when it is actually exactly the opposite. If ever there were an anti-sovereignty treaty, it is LOST. It speaks volumes about the lengths to which this accord's proponents have to go to conceal that reality, that when they are masquerading as advocates of U.S. sovereignty, not what they really are, champions of an effort greatly to reduce it. As it happens, the poster child of this bait and switch may be former senator turned lobbyist, your friend and mine, Trent Lott. It's true. It's true. In October of 2007, former Senator Majority Leader Trent Lott actually circulated a letter to his colleagues urging that the law of the Sea Treaty be withdrawn from consideration by what was once known as the world's greatest deliberative body. This letter warned that, quote, to affect the treaty's broad regime of governance, we are particularly concerned the United States sovereignty would be subjugated in many areas to a supranational government that is chartered by the United Nations under the 1982 Convention. Further, we are troubled that compulsory dispute resolution could pertain to public and private activities including law enforcement, maritime security, business operations, and non-military activities performed aboard military vessels, close quote. Today, however, good old politician-turned-lobbyist, Senator Trent Lott, represents, you got it, Shell Oil. His job is to lobby his former colleagues not to sign a letter that has the exact same language in it, word for word. Is that because the treaty is no longer a threat to the U.S. sovereignty at the hands of a supranational government that is chartered by the United Nations under the 1992 convention? Or is it simply that Senator Trent Lott is now a gun for hire, willing, like the campaign he is, helping advance to do or say whatever it takes to get a seriously defective treaty ratified? Now, we've talked about that part of it. How defective is this treaty? Well, let's consider the following illustrative examples of its fatal flaws. Are you ready for this? You want to know how the agency government works? This is how it works. First, as Senator Trent Lott once warned, ratification of Lost would commit the United States to submit to mandatory dispute resolution with respect to U.S. military and industrial operations. While Lost proponents argued that the United States will choose available arbitration mechanisms to avoid legal decisions from the International Court of Justice, which is a kangaroo joke of a court, or the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, also a joke of a court, such arbitration panels are no less perilous for U.S. interests, as the decisive swing arbiters would be appointed by generally unfriendly UN-affiliated bureaucrats that hate the United States. The arbitration panels can also be relied upon to look to rulings by the ICJ, that's the International Kangaroo Court of Justice, or the ITLOS, which is the International Tribunal for the Kangaroo Law of the Sea, to inform their own decisions. In other words, it's the fox watching the hen house there. Furthermore, while there is a Lost provision exempting military activity from such dispute resolution mechanisms, the treaty makes no attempt to define military activity, virtually guaranteeing that such matters will be litigated. In other words, military vessels will be sued, and they will have to produce discovery, and they'll have to reveal what they were doing, where they were going, what they were carrying. It will destroy the sovereignty of the United States Navy. In all likelihood, to our detriment, by the way, before one or another of Lost's arbitration mechanisms. And the rulings of such arbitrators cannot be appealed. Then you might be able to ignore them, but guess who you're going to go to war with? Yeah, you're going to go to war with a coalition of nations. So why step into that noose in the first place? Subjecting our military to the risks of such mandatory dispute resolution is all the more imprudent given that Lost provides the Navy with no navigational rights and freedoms beyond those it already enjoys under customary international law and the U.S. Freedom of Navigation Program. The Navy has successfully protected American interests on the seas for more than 200 years anywhere there's water. Rivers, bays, oceans, without the United States becoming party to Lost, including during the 30 years since Lost was concluded in 1982. There is no compelling reason to believe that the record will be improved upon by entrusting the job to international legal arrangements. Now, the second negative thing about this Law of the Sea treaty contains provisions that risk putting sensitive, and in some cases militarily useful, information and technology in the hands of America's adversaries and its companies' commercial competitors. Claims by Lost's proponents that this problem was fixed by a 1994 agreement that was not signed by all Lost's parties cry out for close examination by the Senate and the nation. but they don't read stuff before they pass it. They only bow to administration pressure. Now, there's a third negative about this. The Law of the Sea Treaty entails commitments that have far-reaching implications for U.S. businesses. Forget about the military. We have intellectual property that is traveling on the open oceans. These include embroiling this country in treaties bearing on commercial activities to which it is not a party, wide-ranging, intrusive, and expensive environmental obligations, creating standing for foreign nationals to pursue alien torts in our courts. That means malicious prosecution. And jeopardizing our rights under the World Trade Organization, which was established after 1994. Of particular concern is the fact that LOST creates an international taxation regime. Dun, dun, dun. You got it. Taxation without representation. It does so by empowering the International Seabed Authority, that's the ISA, to, that's right, you guessed it, tax Americans for the purposes of meeting its own administrative costs and of globally redistributing revenue derived from the exploitation of seabed resources. It is a travesty to portray a treaty with such clearly sovereignty-sapping provisions as an enhancement to our national sovereignty. Exactly the opposite is true. LOST should be rejected this time, as President Reagan did 30 years ago, and as Senator Lott urged 25 years ago. We're not talking about the new Senator Lott turned lobbyist. We're talking about the old Senator Lott, who did a good job for us as Senate Majority Leader. Well, let's take a quick break here and see if we can get our voice, get something to drink, and we'll be right back after this. This is the Alice Band with After the Gold Rush.
Come saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned-out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Well, all right, Earth Explorers, welcome back to X-Squared Radio. Hour 2. This is May 20th. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. It is a real, real pleasure to have you here with us. By the way, I really want to thank you all for the excellent mail. My motorcycle encounter with a vehicle wasn't too successful for the bike. It's totaled. Wasn't too successful for me because I'm still recovering from my injuries. But none the worse for wear. I'll heal. The bike, however, is done. And I mean done. That's the last two-wheel meditation I'm going to do. I'll just have to bring it up in memory from now on instead of experiencing it. Too many responsibilities, and this just hurts too darn bad. But thank you so much for the mail. I also wanted to express my gratitude for your support for X Squared Radio. Many of you wrote me and said, hey, you ran an archive tonight. I didn't get my Brooks fix. I will make every effort to continue to go live at X Squared Radio on the BBS Radio Network every Sunday evening from 5 to 8 Pacific Time. It's something I've grown to enjoy over the last 7 years. You have been my friends over these years. We have explored the depths of the universe and back together. And we're going to continue to do great things. That's why we're here. Not to do the mundane, not to fill our garages with toys, not to worry and to stress over how we're going to get through the next day. We're here to do great things. We're here to create life in our own image. We're here to love and to be loved. We're here to imagine and to see those imaginations come to pass. Actually, for good or for ill. Hopefully for good. But far be it from me to tell you what to do with your life or your goals. I can tell you there's great value in each and every one of you being here on the planet. And if your consciousness were to leave this universe, the entire thing would collapse back in on itself and we would have to start all over again. You're important. You're integral to the consciousness formula that makes up this planet. 7 billion strong on this planet, there is no inconsequential consciousness. Yes, some of you are asleep. Yes, some of you are waking up, crawling forth out of the fog of dogma or tradition and realizing that you have been alive many times and you've accomplished many things and you have accomplished many failures. Learn from those, grow from those, bring that wisdom forward to this moment and only have moments, one after the other. Don't recycle the negativity back into your life. Let that ebb away. Clear it through the meditation that we've tried to teach you over the last few years. If you want to become an expert at it, I'll set you up with Maureen St. Germain, and she can train you even better at that meditation so that you can clear that negativity from your life. Once that's gone, once you really have a handle on stepping forward in a positive way, you can do anything you want. And you can be anything you want. And I don't mean the finished product, but you can definitely get on the path. You can definitely be what you want to be. I have a couple of appearances coming up. You know about the Maya 2012 one, ending in December, on December 22nd, 2012. I promise to have you home by Christmas. You should see yourself there. I'm going to be there. I want you to be there because we're going to make a presentation about remembering the future, and it is going to be amazing. It will change your life. Everything that goes on there is going to be world-changing, and we're going to be in the right place at the right time when the calendar flips back to not zero, new beginning. You can be there with us. Click on the Maya 2012 banner at xsquaredradio.com and join us. If you're not able to get international, you can do the Pythagoras conference. Click on the blue banner. You'll get $100 off. Plus, you can join us in the Midwest. Can you believe it? The Midwest. We're going to do a giant conference with 50 of the world's best speakers. So let's get started with our second hour of X Squared Radio. We have had many requests to talk about the interaction of consciousness and matter. I get a lot of emails and a lot of Skype messages that say that, you know, maybe this has its own effects, but I'm going to talk about it anyway. This entrepreneurial, I'm going to call it a fountainhead that seems to be springing forth all around the world, literally all around the world, China, India, people I talk to in Europe, of course, all over the United States. Now, this could be because of economic forces. You know, North Carolina is leading the nation in single location businesses. And, you know, a lot of people, including my associates in government, in the governor's office and even in the mayor's office here and city councils, county commissions, they're surprised to hear this fact. But North Carolina leads the nation in single location businesses. Sounds like an ignominious fact, but what it really means, since North Carolina officially has a 9.5% unemployment rate, and unofficially it's probably close to 16.5%. This is a state that has been hit particularly hard because it was nearly completely wiped out when the furniture and textile industries left the country. This was before the recession hit in 2008. Then the recession hit in 2008. We lost close to 7,000 banking jobs. We're about ready to lose 3,000 more with Bank of America. We have lost manufacturing. We have no automotive content in the state whatsoever. There is in South Carolina, but not in North Carolina. We are a diversified state, and yet we have great secondary schools. Great secondary schools, very smart people. And if smart people can't find a job, they will create a job. That's the reason why there's more single location businesses in North Carolina than any place on the country. Smart people, when they're out of work and they're out of handouts, and this isn't really a big state on handouts, they pull up themselves and they make something happen. I don't care whether they're street vendors or whether they're contractors or painters or mechanics or whether they're engineers or bricklayers. They form their own business. They go out and find their own work, and they get themselves some money. They are taking control of their own sovereignty, as is the state. And you're seeing that because almost 4 years ago, this state voted for Obama. And I'm just going to say that as a political party, the Democrats, even though the state has a fair balance in its Congress and senators between the two-party system, our leanings toward the presidency went Democratic. The administration is counting on that again. In fact, North Carolina is one of those states that's considered a swing state. It isn't. It isn't. It's done. Stick a fork in it, it's done. Yes, the Democrat convention's going to be here, and it's going to dump a few million dollars into the city of Charlotte. But the city of Charlotte has 25,000 people that are out of work. For a city the size of Charlotte, that's a disaster. And it is felt from top to bottom. So what's causing it? What makes this happen? How does human consciousness drive us to pull ourselves up and make us be something? How do we not become a state of mind of protest, but we become a state of mind of progress? We build ourselves an empire, and we make it happen. That is something that is difficult to explain. Is it uniquely American? Possibly, because it's a good theater for it to happen. But I think it's pretty much global. We're seeing it happen in China, too. We're seeing it happen in India. About the only place we're not seeing it happen is Greece. All Greece appears to care about is how soon they're going to get their next government check. when they retire at 60, and they receive a government check until they grow old and die, which could be 100. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine getting a government check for 40 years? Half your life? You're getting a government check for doing what? For doing what? For eating and drinking and breathing air? What did you do to deserve a whole salary that lasts your whole life and only working half of it? Well, you and I both know the answer to that. You don't. You don't. It can't happen. Your country will go broke. And that's exactly what's happening. So if it is not universal, what makes it happen? I'm open to your ideas, too. I'm going to propose some of my ideas here, but I'm open to yours. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. For one thing, I think that there are places on the earth that are special. And that doesn't mean that one area's, you know, nationality has anything to do with it. I just think there are locations on the earth where the grid, where some kind of energy, some kind of ley line or some kind of grid in the sky or link to earth lines of energy are important. They bring a synergy to the consciousness of the human being. It's less of a wasteland. It's more of a productive cycle. And I think one of those locations is the U.S. I think one of those locations in ancient times was Tibet. Not so anymore, but it was. If you look at Israel, you look at the area around the Dome of the Rock, obviously one of the points at which off-world high intelligence, be it God or other angelic beings, have communicated with men and women on a regular basis, not so much around the world, but right there for sure. We've had other beings, the shining ones, of course, in South America and in the western United States and in the northern climes of Canada, Alaska. We've had the shining ones, the great spirits, come down and speak to men and teach them things. There are records in every age, almost in every culture, from Singapore to Arizona, where off-world beings have communicated with humans here on the earth and have mostly, I would say mostly, been beneficial. Some of them have taught men to worship. Some of them have taught men to lust after power and to use weaponry and warfare, death and mayhem to gain power. But I think most of them, for the large part, has been trying to teach humans how to be the higher being that they are. And we haven't always been empowered to do that because we've had to spend most of the day, you know, foraging for food or purifying water or building a shelter, responding to nature in one way or another, whether it's driving rains or pestilence or drought or snow or winds, storms, earthquakes, volcanoes. We've been running from nature for 40,000 years. But beyond that, once we find that place of synergy, once we find that place of creativity where we can divide up the responsibilities of a community among specialists so that it frees up a family to do one job and then take care of the job of raising children. And now we're to the point where we're so specialized, we have virtually three-quarters of our time. Three-quarters of our time is free time. We may work 8 hours a day, but that's only 5 days a week. You know, there's 480 hours in a work week plus the 48 hours of the weekend, and we don't work but 40 of them. So you can see that the ratio is, and by the way, those of you that work 40 hours a week, you're not successful. You won't be ever successful. You take those of us, I haven't worked a 40-hour week in 20 years, maybe more than 20 years. If I don't work 90 hours a week, I'm going nowhere. And virtually everyone I know who is successful, from the producers of this program to officers of other corporations with whom I deal, to engineers, to inventors. None of them work 40-hour weeks. That's ridiculous to think that you can be successful working a 40-hour week. It's just never going to happen. If you're only working 40 hours a week, you know, you are a slave. You should get a second job or a third job or go to school or something with that extra time, because you are wasting your time here on this earth if you do not. But I find it highly rewarding because I love what I do. I love what I do, and that is part of the paycheck for me. And it allows me to do great things. Hence, my great desire to keep doing it. And I think you should do the same thing. Do not despair, because although, and I will explain this here in just a little bit, it appears as though all the card players have come to the table and played all the money away, and no one can ante up. It appears someone has taken all the money off the table, and we don't really know who it is. I'd like to find out, wouldn't you? Not that I want to go redistribute it, but come on, you know, people, I want to get back in the game here. I want to get back in the deal. You know, somebody is sitting on all that money, and that's not right. It has to be played. It has to be in circulation. If it's taken out of circulation, then we're going to have to do something else. That's all there is to it, because consciousness will prevail. Now, the one thing I want to do is try to explain the classes of consciousness. You often hear me say people are not conscious that they're conscious. Well, you've seen them. I mean, when you go to work tomorrow, you're driving along in your car by yourself or with someone else in the car. Traffic gets slow enough and it's safe. Do this. Do this. Look into the car next to you. Uh-huh. That dead person behind the wheel. Complete blank expression. No one home. Nothing going on. Going through the motions of going to work and coming home, and life is crap, and then you die. Those people are not conscious that they're conscious. But their consciousness is affecting the average consciousness of this reality. Are they awake? No. Can they be awakened? Possibly. But it is going to take a critical mass of awakenedness. So let's talk about the awake ones. The awake ones are also in three classes. One is, I'm awake, but I'm in a complete state of confusion. I see a whole bunch of speeding cars going by, and I'm awake, but I'm standing on the sidewalk, and I don't know where to go, and I don't know what to do. I don't know who to listen to. I've never been here before. I'm lost. Yeah, you're awake, but you're lost. These people tend to find camping spots. Okay? You know, when it talks about all rivers flow to the ocean, these are the people that bob up and down in the water. Oh, they're awake and everything, but they're bobbing, and they're going out to sea. And some of them are flailing around in the water because they don't know how to swim. They swim from one bank to the other, to the other. They group together, finding out nobody in the group has a clue, and out to sea they go. Okay, the other two are what makes this world happen. One knows what's going on and tries to take advantage of it to make themselves wealthy, to try to give themselves dominion over others. And I can tell you right now that as soon as a man or woman practices their consciousness to gain dominion over another, they have crossed over into a realm of, yes, awareness, yes, consciousness, but it's dark consciousness. Now, unfortunately, many of these individuals end up in leadership positions because that's where they're happy. That's where they push themselves. And we see them ripping us off right and left. A billion here, a billion there, a trillion here, a trillion there, and they trying to get between them and a camera is one of the most dangerous places you can think of. They have consciousness, but it's dark. You can sense it as soon as they open their mouths. You can sense it as soon as you look into their eyes. As soon as you shake their hand, you realize that they have nefarious designs, dark consciousness. Oh, they're awake, And they know how the system works. And the system works in resonance and in chaos. It works mathematically, and you cannot, I repeat, cannot deny it. They will become powerful, and they will rule the world. The third kind of consciousness are the ones that are awake, and they have a high consciousness. They have a consciousness of love. They have a consciousness of no fear. They have a consciousness that does not thrive on great amounts of personal wealth. They don't lust after the flesh. They don't lust after the pride of life. They have a joy about them in helping one another, healing one another, writing music, writing books, you know, being engineers, creating things, working with plants, bringing alternative energy to the market. This higher consciousness has a much higher vibration. However, it isn't as intense of an energy, even though it's a very bright light. It's not as intense of an energy as the fear side of consciousness. So it takes a lot more of us, about 64 times as many light consciousness people as it does dark consciousness people, to make the planet begin to change the average consciousness. And you'd think that that's insurmountable, but it isn't. In most societies, average societies, it's about 50 to 1. 50 people that will spontaneously obey the rules and regulations of the community, that will seek out the betterment of the community as opposed to singular accomplishment and wealth at the expense of others. 2% or 1 out of 50 of those people will seek self-aggrandizement and wealth at the expense of others. That's why we have police. Police take care of these 2%. They practice a self-destructive lifestyle. They use drugs. They drink alcohol to excess. They practice risky lifestyles, both sexually and from a thrill-seeking, violent kind of way. And you can spot them a mile away, and you can sense in the energy of their voice when they describe the activities that they do. Within 60 seconds, you'll recognize them right away. The light consciousness ones and the dark consciousness ones are so easy to tell the difference. Unfortunately, the vast majority of our society is in the first class I told you about. They're not conscious that they're conscious. Now, these make good fodder for both of the other classes. The dark ones, of course, love to enslave the ones who have no consciousness or are unaware. They make great factory workers by the tens of millions. They sit in sweatshops all around the world, sewing and doing electronics and painting and stamping and welding and on and on and on, and they have no life. They go into work, they work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they grow old and they die. They have no imaginations, they have no hobbies, they have no thoughts, they take no vacations. They are taken advantage of by the dark side, by the dark consciousness. They're also wooed by the light consciousness people. When we have conferences and classrooms and seminars and salons, we teach them, we heal them, we give radio programs to them, we write books to them, we sing songs to them. We try to wake them up on the light side so that they wake up and realize, hey, I don't have to live to work. I can work to live. It's a big difference. I can become free from the slavery of debt. I can lower and simplify my lifestyle to live within my means. And I can do this individually. I can do it as a community. I can do it as a state. I could do it as a nation. That's a bigger battle, but it's one to which we are dedicated. It is one to which we spend our energy every day. Now, there are some of very well-organized forces in the world that are trying to take advantage of the stalemate, the stagnant state of the economy right now. You know, our economy, and I'll explain this in a little bit just by the numbers, excuse me. our economy is not so much based on gold. It's not based on silver. It isn't based on the contract to pay, the hours for which you sweat or toil or think and create value and put it into the system. The global economy is set up on flow. It's set up on the flow of money from the bottom to the top and then from the top back down. It has to make this one round, around and around and around. The company has to be built and has to pay the hourly worker. The hourly worker goes out and buys the purse or the belt or the car or the computer or the piece of software which drives the profits of the company that provides the jobs. You see the cycle? It ain't rocket science, people. Come on. I mean, it is rocket science, but we explain it very carefully in the book Remembering the Future. The idea is that the economy keeps rolling. It keeps moving the money. But when the money stops moving, the dominoes begin to fall. Because payroll can't be made, people are laid off. People are laid off, then they can't pay their bills. The bills don't get paid, and the companies that make those things can't make a profit. They can't make a profit, they go out of business. They go out of business, and the homes that are financed by all the wages that come from that business go into foreclosure. And it goes on and on and on. You see how it works. So it's not a simple thing to say, well, let's put everybody back to work. Believe it. That's what the federal government, that's what all the governments are trying to do. Let's give people a paycheck so we can get money moving again. Except the money doesn't move from the people who have it. It moves from the people who do not have it. And so that's improper. That system doesn't work. Now, this is one of the rare times in May of 2012 when there are two key meetings back to back. One is the NATO alliance, the North American Treaty Organization. You'll recall this was set up after World War I to organize the nations of the world, the Allies, against the Axis powers, so that if we ever went to war again, we'd have the economic and military capability to share the burden and beat the threat. Well, since all that's gone, you'd think, well, gee, there's no need for the NATO anymore. Not true. Once you create a bureaucracy, you have to keep it. So today, the president unveiled a new package of NATO initiatives that includes the alliance purchasing a fleet of surveillance drones. We talked about that last week. 30,000 drones that'll be in the air over the United States. Also sharing weapons and training facilities in order to lower cost and consolidate methodologies between like nations. And sustaining nuclear deterrence in Europe even as disarmament efforts continue with an often belligerent Russia, according to senior administration officials. You heard us read to you last week that Russia stated, not the president, but a senior member of the administration stated that they would preemptively strike if NATO did not remove its anti-missile system. NATO claims that the anti-missile system is there to prevent against Iranian rockets which might land in Europe, and Russia doesn't believe them. Although debate on winding down the Afghan war will dominate NATO summit meeting in Chicago, Mr. Obama also will disclose agreements designed to guarantee mutual security in an era of global austerity that includes sharply reduced military spending across the alliance. Austerity, as you well know, is being cut off from your allowance. Okay? All the little benefits that government can give out are cut off, but all the requirements of government are still there. You still have to pay this fee. You still have to get this license. You still have to register this. You're still subject to these fines. But as far as government giving anything out to you, those things are cut back. A central element of Mr. Obama's announcement will be a handover to NATO of control for the components of an emerging European missile defense system built by the United States. This is a particular thorn in the side of Russia. A radar station in Turkey, which has been there a long, long time, will become permanently under alliance command. In times of crisis, American Navy Aegis warships with radar and interceptor missiles would be transferred to, you got it, NATO command. When interceptor missiles planned for Poland and Romania are in place, they would also be placed under NATO command in time of crisis. Again, we are relinquishing our sovereignty to an organization that is not run by the United States. Another major agreement is that the alliance will purchase and maintain 5 Global Hawk surveillance drones, said one administration official who spoke on condition of anonymity, to describe the initiatives in advance of the meeting. Although NATO carried out an offensive that toppled Libya's Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi, the campaign revealed a critical gap in the alliance's warfighting capabilities. Well, that's because, Mr. President, it was actually the Libyan people that were on the streets there, riding around in Toyota pickup trucks and loafers with jogging suits, shooting 50 caliber machine guns. We didn't do anything except fly around and, you know, take a few pot shots at stuff. We just provided intelligence, okay? We did not fight that war. The United States had a near monopoly on surveillance and reconnaissance aircraft, and NATO needed its own remotely piloted vehicles. In addition to this, back-to-back was the 38th G8 summit, which was held in Camp David, Maryland. It just concluded, 18th and 19th. The event occurred just before the NATO summit, which was yesterday. The G8 summit was moved from Chicago, where it was going to be held back-to-back with the NATO summit, over to Camp David, Maryland. But the two are pretty close to one another. What they wanted to do was just sort of divide up the protesters because they were afraid of the protesters, and the protesters showed up anyway. Most of them were peaceable. 2 or 3 of them decided to get kind of nasty and make Molotov cocktails, but they were quickly apprehended. Now, this is the first G8 summit in which the Russian head of state, in this case Vladimir Putin, did not attend. Dmitry Medvedev, the prime minister of Russia, attended instead. And you should probably know that Mr. Putin is arguably the wealthiest man on the earth today. Yeah, it's true. You know, post-communist, post-KGB, blah, blah, blah. You want to know how bad the crime, how bad the dark consciousness is in Russia? Well, you now know Mr. Putin is the wealthiest man in the world today. The announcement was made yesterday that Mr. Obama, entering the Senate, and the Senate wages were a massive increase in amount of money for him. It has been 3 years, and now Mr. Obama's personal net worth is over $10 million. It's over $10 million, his personal net worth, just so you know. A lot of stuff going on the side. So what are the 8 countries? Well, we have France, which is now run by the avowed socialist, François Hollande. We have Germany with Angela Merkel as the chancellor, Italy with Mario Monti, prime minister, Japan with Yoshihiko Noda, prime minister, Russia, not the president, but Dmitry Medvedev, the prime minister, United Kingdom with David Cameron, and of course the United States with Barack Obama. Of these countries, just wanted to run this by you. The following is a list of the national debt of these countries. Okay, this is supposedly the 8 financially strongest countries in the world. I just named them: France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Russia, United States, and United Kingdom. In this one, we have the United Kingdom divided out. So I have 9, or I have 8, but it's the United States is $15 trillion in debt. The United Kingdom is almost $10 trillion in debt. And add Ireland to that, which is another $3 trillion. Then you have Germany at $5 trillion. You have France at $5 trillion. You have Japan at $3 trillion. You have Norway at almost $3 trillion. You have Italy at $2.5 trillion. And the G8 members of the European nations are now more than $30 trillion in debt. Now, if you add Greece, Spain, Austria, the Czech Republic, and the others, and the debt is well over $60 trillion. $60 trillion. The total European economy is only $40 trillion. As you can see, the players have all been playing cards for about a half a century now, and no one can afford to ante up. So who has all the money? Any clues out there? Any clues at all? 888-429-5471. Did the money exist at all, ever? That's a good question. So the reason I bring this up is because it's important to see how consciousness is involved in how Earth is put together. You can see the results of this, how the dark consciousness, those that are awake, they are aware of their consciousness, they are aware of their ability to create the universe, they are creators, but they are creating a dark, subservient kind of society. They're heavily in debt, and yet they call themselves the most powerful nations in the world. They are telling the rest of the world how they're going to live. They're not only setting up the North American Treaty Organization to, quote, defend the Allied nations, but they're also setting up the economics to control the rest of the world. And they're creating it because they are consciously organized to do it. Now, what does the light side do? What do the people with higher consciousness do? Well, some would say they're taking to the streets. They're making peace signs in front of the cameras, and they're holding everything up because they're the 99%. They want to take from the 1% and give to the 99%. Do you really think that's the higher consciousness? You think that's the higher consciousness that's here to save this world? Do you think that's the awakening that we are destined to see when Venus transits the sun? The window is open. The key is put in the lock. The clock is reset to a new beginning in the age of Aquarius. Do you think this is what Jesus was talking about when he said at the end of the age these catastrophes and cataclysms would happen and then they would be precipitated by the greed and lust of men? You know what? It's very possible. It's very possible. But because we know that story, because we've already read that story, we already know that plot. Guys, we've already seen that movie. Except that this is an interactive movie. We can change the middle of it. We can change the end of it. We can change the outcome and make things happen the way we want them to happen. And the Earth is going to respond to that, just like the Earth responds to the dark forces. Now, I've heard lots of people hit the news and say, people that think that this country got hit by a tsunami or this country got hit by a hurricane, this area of the world and that area of the world, because of the terrible debauchery that they were doing in this area. And they laugh it off. They say, look, it was just a tsunami. So what if 250,000 people died? So what if it was one of the most nefarious child slavery, sold into sexual slavery areas of the world? You know, when the 9th district or the 9th parish in Louisiana was hit and wiped out just because it was one of the seediest, most nefarious havens for drug and criminal elements in the country, just because it was wiped clean by that hurricane, and now it is, all those people are gone. All those neighborhoods are replaced, either with nothing but sand or with high-end housing and condominiums and shopping centers, and that element's now gone. That black hole into which people that did not wish to have an identity, they were so dark in their consciousness, hid from society and yet influenced us across the world with their crimes. They're gone. You could say what you want about it. Like, for instance, tropical Tropical Storm Alberto emerged off South Carolina's coastline today. It's the first storm of its kind to form in a hurricane season that doesn't officially begin until June 1st. Storm was not expected to approach landfall on the Carolinas coast, but it prompted a tropical storm watch, and forecasters warned that could produce high winds, heavy surf, rip currents, and scattered rain across the region. The National Hurricane Center of Miami reported at 8 o'clock this morning on Eastern Time that Alberto, after forming Saturday in the Atlantic, was about 95 miles southeast of Charleston, South Carolina. The storm had maximum sustained winds of 50 miles an hour with higher gusts and was moving west-southwest about 6 miles per hour. Tropical storm force winds extended outward up to 70 miles from the center. Does Earth respond to these fluctuations in human consciousness? You know, it's not homogeneous. You know, you can have a whole bunch of terrible activity taking place in China. It doesn't mean there's going to be a storm in the Gulf of Mexico. I think that these things are regional. I think the Earth has allergic reactions when dark consciousness is inserted into the grid of the Earth. That's just my personal opinion. I would love to hear yours on the subject. 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Does human consciousness, which is a measurable quantum input into the net energy of the Earth by human consciousness that's awake and either dark or light, have an effect on what the Earth is doing? And if so, and I believe that it does, I maintain that it does, I know that it does, if so, how can we manipulate that effect? What can we do with this wonderful planet that we have if we have the right consciousness? And the things that we've been covering since the first of the year lead me to believe that, in a large sense, the leadership of this country, the leadership of the world, is not going in the right direction. I mean, I see the signs of the times as well as anyone else. And we have a sun that is also involved in this solar system. We have a planet that is set up to defend itself against the sun with a magnetosphere and with a lovely ocean. And we have an ozone layer that protects us against shortwave radiation. We have houses. We only spend about 15 to 18% of our time out of doors anyway. The rest of the time we're in shelter. We're either in our cars or we're in a building. And we're shielded from these high-energy protons. Our lifespan is thus tripled. And as long as we don't keep messing with nuclear explosions and nuclear waste, like we saw from Fukushima, then the race of man will continue to evolve. I think already we live longer than a tree. We can live longer than that, and we can live good quality of lives longer than that. But do we want the dark consciousness to prevail, or do we want the light consciousness to prevail? Well, there are a lot of hosts on BBS Radio Network that talk about this balance and imbalance of consciousness much more vocally than I do. But I do talk about it from a net energy point of view, that if you continue to put negative numbers into a system, eventually the result will become negative. And you can't complain about the result, because that's where you were aiming, folks. I mean, it's not like golf where you aim one way and the ball goes another way. No, 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 no. The ball goes exactly where you aimed if you're in the consciousness business. So all I'm saying is, here we are, you and I, just between us, just between friends, talking about higher consciousness, talking about how consciousness gets involved with the act of creation, talking about the net result of how that consciousness affects the average reality that each one of us experience. So what are you going to do about it? Well, you've got a good start on it. You're listening to this program. That's good. You've probably read some books that I've written. You may have even been to a seminar that I've given. If you haven't, you certainly have a couple chances this year, for sure. I'm going to be August, October, and December of this year. We'll be doing conferences, one in Arizona, one in Indiana, and one in Chichen Itza. And you and your friends can tune in here each Sunday night, and we'll talk about it. So I don't know how much more talking I have to do about what is the dark side doing, what is this dark consciousness that's awake and aware, and yet has made a conscious decision to take negative steps toward self-aggrandizement and self-enrichment at the expense of others, before you wake up, before you realize what power you have. And some states are doing it. I can tell you this right now. It is going on. I was just reading a story the other day about Florida. Let's see if I can find it really quick here. Here we go. It's actually a good story about Florida. We've not heard very much good election news out of Florida in years past. Seems like we always end up in Florida talking about one thing or another. But in this particular case, this week, guess what they found? They found 53,000 dead voters in Florida. It's true. Registered zombie voters. You know, remember what we talked about in my latest book, Alienated Nation, the news that SCYTL, S-C-Y-T-L, had purchased the SOE, U.S. software company that counts all the U.S. votes, and that the Secretary of State of Florida had asked him to write a piece of software that would change the vote in the voting machines and then erase itself so that it couldn't be traced. And he said, well, certainly it can be done, but I'm not going to do it. And so he went and testified to Congress instead. You remember that? And you remember that I stated the fastest growing age group in America is the over 100 group? Well, I may have been wrong. That they're even older than that. I have learned that Florida election officials are set to announce, you'll probably hear it tomorrow in the news, that the Secretary of State has discovered and purged up to 53,000 dead voters from the voter rolls in Florida. And it's worse than you think. How could 53,000 dead voters have sat on the polls for so long? It's simple. Because Florida hadn't been using the best available data revealing which voters have died. Florida is now using the nationwide Social Security Death Index, which is very reliable, for determining which voters should be purged because they have died. Now here's the bad news. Most states aren't using the same database that Florida is. In fact, I have heard reports that some election officials won't even remove voters, even when they are presented with a death certificate. That means the voter rolls across the nation are still filled with dead people, even if Florida is leading the way in detecting and removing them. I mean, surely people aren't voting in the names of the dead voters. Yeah. They actually are. The voter fraud deniers argue, but they're wrong. Consider the case of Lafayette Keaton. Keaton was not only voted out for a dead person in Oregon. I'm sorry. Keaton not only voted for a dead person in Oregon, he voted for his dead son. Making Keaton's fraud easier was Oregon's vote-by-mail scheme, which has opened up gaping holes in the integrity of elections. The incident in Oregon just scratches the surface of the problem. Massachusetts, Michigan, Mississippi, Indiana, there are other examples of the dead rising on election day. Florida should be applauded for taking the problem seriously, even if Eric Holder's Justice Department and many state election officials don't. It won't be easy for Florida to pull off another Democrat close call. I think the margin may be large this time. I hope there is time to sweep up the other schemes that are out there. Oh, yes, there is darkness. There are dark designs out there. Dead people. You already know from investigative reporting that we've talked about on this program already that many petitions to put candidates onto various ballots in various states have been fraudulent, that the number, names and numbers and everything were just looked up in the phone book, filled in, the signatures were forged, and years after the primary election, investigators went out and found that not only did those people never sign the petition, they would never, ever in that particular election have put that person on the ballot in the first place. And so you have, you know, people from Newt Gingrich, you have people from Hillary Clinton, you have people from Barack Obama, that all of these various petitions to put them on the ballot were fraudulent. That is to say, the people never knew that their names were being put on there. Yes, there are dark designs going on. Of course there are. And I don't really know what to do about it, but except to keep you aware of it so that you know. And I would just make sure that your state and local officials know this. Maybe you can't ask for identification, but you can make sure no dead people walk through. Maybe you can put, you know, some kind of person there that snaps a picture of everybody that goes in and votes, not what they vote for, or who they vote for, but then match up those pictures to see if they go in there more than once. And they get around this too, by the way. They take busloads of people from one county to another county to another county, and they vote multiple times in multiple, they vote multiple times, but they vote in multiple precincts. And so, yes, they're only seen going in one time, but they're not voting for themselves. They're voting for someone else. And that's the way it goes. Let's take a break right now. We'll listen to a little of Enigma. And we'll be back right after this with more X Squared Radio. Thank you very much.
Better world.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of the program this May 20th, 2012. Third and final hour of X Squared Radio if you want to be part of the program. It's 888-429-5471. Wanted to make a quick announcement on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. Many of you have been writing, you know, it's 2012. We talked at great lengths about the project over the years and our challenges in raising the funding. Well, guess what? The challenge has been met. It's true. We finally have a producer who sees the value of the expedition from a monetary point of view, from a consciousness point of view. It's something that they want to do. And they're going to put up the funds for the charter. It is, however, not going to happen in 2012. The charter is going to be booked this year. But we're going to have to book for the summer of 2013. It may actually be a good thing. We'll get through this this 2012 advent. We will see that all will be well if you're of a higher consciousness mind, I believe. And then the world will be ready for this wonderful new discovery. And it's going to be done right. The right kind of production quality, the right kind of film behind it, the right kind of leadership, the highest consciousness possible throughout the organization will be employed and utilized. So that is our global announcement right here on X Squared Radio. I will make changes to our three websites that pertain to this. One is npiee.org, and then there's, of course, nippy.com. And then there's also the phoenixsciencefoundation.org. The two organizations are separate. Phoenix Science Foundation is the nonprofit that handles all the funds. Also, we do a lot in regard to alternative energy. You can see some of the projects that we've already completed there. And the NPIEE is a coalition that's put together between Rodney Clough, James Sills, several other leaders around the world that have not just been believers, they've been knowers of this technology, about the Hollow Earth theory for a long, long time. I, for the record, am not a proponent of the Hollow Earth, although I do talk about a Hollow Earth theory as a theory, the experiment that we're about to conduct to prove or disprove that theory. It is very mainstream, it is very legitimate, and it is pure science, I assure you. None of us with this organization are crackpots, and we're going to bring you the very best evidence that we can. That being said, many, many hundreds of you have written wanting to say, I want to go, I want to go, I want to go, and I understand that. There are 100 spaces. Most of those spaces are going to be taken up by scientists. They're going to be taking data, measurements, and also learning and taking courses and classes to raise their consciousness. Filmmakers and their support staff, the organizers themselves, and there are some discretionary seats, 20 to 40 discretionary seats. We don't know how many just yet because we're not ready to solidify that until the time actually happens. Maybe a couple of you still need to apply. You go to nippy.org, fill out the form, put in your name, the reason you want to come, and your name will be in the database. I promise you every single solitary name will be considered. And there will be alternates. Because this is going to take place 6 to 9 months away from the time when we make the charter and make the announcements, many things change. Unfortunately, you know, some people will not be alive at the time that the voyage happens. Because that's just the nature of the odds of things, you know. You have a couple hundred people, things come up. They have family things that come up, jobs things that come up, health reasons that come up, and even death. And so we have to have alternates as well. So just don't despair. There aren't that many names, a few thousand, but it's certainly not like a few million. Even though we have tens of millions of enthusiasts, not nearly that number have applied. So we'll make the changes to the website. We'll go on with Mr. Nouri on Coast to Coast and make an announcement here shortly. I also wanted to remind you, if you're new to this program, I just the last couple of weeks released my latest book, Alienated Nation, The New Quest for Liberty. And there, you could buy it anywhere you want online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc., etc. Or you can buy it from my website, alienatednation.com. And if you buy from my website, then you will get an autographed copy and you will get the entire book in audio for free. Now, that being said, there was a group, rather large group, that took advantage of my early bird special. This is when the book was finished. It was through editing and it was going through publishing. And I threw a 30% discount on the book and let you purchase early. In that respect, when you made your purchase, the recorded version of the book was not ready. So if you did not get your recorded version of the book, and you know who you are, write me and I will send you the link. I will make every attempt to go back through PayPal, look up your purchase, and I will send you the link. But if I miss you, I don't want to leave anybody out. You write me with your receipt and I will send you the audio link for nothing. It's cool. I want you to have it. Listen to it on your iPod. Several of the chapters are quite poignant. Also, if you don't have a copy of it, Get Pick Up Remembering the Future of the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. It is a self-help book from a scientific point of view. And it's also pretty easy reading. And, it reveals some things that about myself that perhaps believe me, I arm wrestled quite a bit not putting it in the book because I also have a professional side. But I figured, and I think properly so, I am never going to run for president. So I don't care, really, if you know what happened before I got here or not, as far as how it's going to negatively affect my future. I have no fear about that whatsoever. So, pick it up, learn a little bit about yourself, realize maybe that you're not alone in what you're feeling. You're not alone in some thoughts or suspicions that you have had in the past about maybe why you're not so comfortable here or why you feel like there must be something else to do here besides what I'm doing. then it's a good book for you. And it's designed to help you unlock the wealth of the universe and to help you learn how to reduce the stress, and at least the effects of the stress in your life. You can't reduce the stress in your life. You can't go through life stress-free. But you can change how that stress affects you. You can change how you think about it. You can change how, when it is added to the equation of your life, it is also canceled out rather easily. And I don't mean just self, you know, affirmations, talking in the mirror or slapping yourself in the face or meditating it away. There is just a way of resonating with your idea so that it continues to build great resonance and self-creative forces out of chaos. Because as we look out into the universe, we see stars. We see points of light, and we know around some of those stars are planets, and we know even in between all those stars there are planets floating around. That's organized matter. It's not dark energy. It's not dark matter. It's not a ball of gas. It's organized matter. So in some respects, there is some self-organizing tendency in the universe, albeit small, because about 95% of the universe is not visible to us. So it is in what we assume is this chaos of dark energy and dark matter, which I attest could be very bright energy and bright matter, so bright we cannot see it, so bright we cannot detect it, or maybe in another dimension. And nevertheless, we feel the effects of it in this dimension because the clusters of galaxies rotate and revolve and act like they are present even though we can't see it or feel it or measure it. We can sort of measure its effect, but we can't measure its presence. So in that respect, a small amount of the universe is self-creative, or it is involved with the consciousness of creation, which is that extra intelligence that's added to the system to allow subatomic particles like protons and electrons to be formed. We do know that a proton is a proton is a proton, with the exception of its average weight, depending on what element it's associated with, whether it's hydrogen all the way down to iron or back up the nuclide chart to the heavier elements, then the proton begins to gain weight again. But it's still a proton. It's just holographically less dense. It loses a little bit of mass. But that being said, we don't get other kinds of subatomic particles. That's it. You know, for everything from hydrogen to the heaviest elements on the chart, they're all protons, unless they're neutrons, which is where an electron and a proton have come together and neutralized the charge. But basically, that's it. You get those particles and nothing else, because those are the only particles that can form. Because when you resonate energy together with consciousness, that is the result. So that's why we are net creators with the earth, or net creators with God. And we're connected to everything that way. And if we're connected, then we can change it. If we're connected, we can manipulate it for good or for ill. And you're already watching the ill part. We've certainly covered enough of that on this program in the last 90 days. And we'll continue to do it because it's a wake-up. It lets you know what happens when you fall asleep, when you're apathetic, when you don't bother to apply yourself to the system. Then the system takes over. The system becomes its own beast. It rises up and becomes untamable with a voracious appetite that eats everything in sight. And even though it looks like humans behind it, it just looks like men and women that work behind a government desk. It's not. It is a behemoth that has enslaved them as well and convinced them that they are different than you, that they're not connected to you, that you are the fatted calf that has to go out there and work in the field all day, and every day when you come in, they carve a little bit off, or they milk you, or they bleed you. And sometimes it results in your death, and that's just too darn bad. But all that's going on out there, all that is a force that we can and must deal with. So we've made the announcement on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We've let you know about the Maya 2012 conference coming up in December, about the Pythagoras conference coming up in October. There's another conference in Arizona, which we'll post here very shortly, that is a wake-up conference. So if you're in that area, I'd love to see you there as well. And now you know about the latest two books. Now, I'm working on another book, but it is not a printed book. This book is an audiobook only because it is written for kids. It's actually written for parents of kids so they can play it for their kids while they're on the road. And it's an interesting set of stories that I used to tell my kids. They liked it so much that they just wanted to see them recorded so that other kids traveling down the highway could listen as well. Sort of like a storybook hour, but on a science fiction level. It's just interesting so that they can be involved in their ride down the freeway. And we'll get that out as soon as we can. X Squared Radio was started 7 years ago in September in 2005 as a one-hour program on Wednesday nights. I was heard on the radio by Don, who's my producer at the BBS Radio Network, asked me if I wanted my own program. I said, "Wow, sure, you know, I'll try it." So we went on 1 hour every Wednesday night for 3 months, and the results were in. It's not going to work. We're so sorry. You need 3 hours, and you're moving to Sunday. And we've been there ever since. So in that period of time, we have grown to be one of the top two radio programs at BBS Radio Network. No thanks to you, or total thanks to you, because you come here and you listen, and you write me emails, and you keep me inspired. And occasionally now we have guests on. For the first 4 years, I interviewed a guest almost every single week, and it was interesting. We covered a lot of different subjects, but I kept getting the mail, "Gee, the guest is fine, but we want to hear more of what you have to say." And so over last year, 2011, we went to a new format where we only had one guest a month, and the other weeks were myself, and the format took off. Whatever we were doing it right. So we continued that pattern this year, and I've had to rent some archives lately because of this crazy motorcycle accident. And you have to understand, I've been driving for almost 40 years. I've been riding motorcycles for well over 35 years, and I've never had an accident before. I've never hit anything. I've never been hit. So I have over 1 million miles behind the wheel with no accidents, and I thought I was about as defensive driver as you can be. And just riding down the road in broad daylight, and this woman came out of an apartment complex and decided that she was going to try and make two bodies of mass occupy the same space at the same time, and I lost. So I don't have anything broken, but a fracture is not compound. It's just a crack through the fibula, which is the bone that's about the size of your index finger behind your shin bone, and C6 and C7, which are, it's a typical football injury, the two lower vertebrae just above the shoulders. Unfortunately for me, or for anyone who gets this kind of fracture, they are key because so many nerves go through those two vertebrae. And in order for the fracture to heal, you have to keep the head from turning left and right. And so in extreme cases, they actually bolt a cage to your head and secure that around your shoulders so you cannot move your head. I didn't have to have that, but I have the next best thing, I suppose, this neck brace that goes down to the bottom of my solar plexus and down below my shoulder blades and is cinched up with Velcro to keep me from moving my head from right to left. And believe me, it is no fun. I definitely like turning my head. I like being able to walk, and so I am on the mend and will be back at 100% within a month, I assure you. And I appreciate the cards and letters that you all sent me. Thank you so much. It warms my heart. I had a couple of people write me after reading the books, and such warm and touching words. I am humbled to the dust. I appreciate it so much that written words down on a piece of paper can affect a life so powerfully. I also wanted to announce that this summer, time permitting, we're going to have some seminars in Charlotte, North Carolina. So if you're within driving distance of Charlotte, North Carolina, $99. I mean, it doesn't get any, well, it can get cheaper than that. I'm going to tell you about that in a second. $99, you come down for a day and a half. You come down for an all-day Saturday and then half a day on Sunday. And we will go completely through the Merkaba meditation that's mentioned in the book face-to-face, so you can master all of the nuances of that in that short amount of time. We will go through a 2.5-hour presentation split into two parts about remembering the future, the physics of the soul, and time travel, which I know you will enjoy. And you get a 55-page work booklet with that, and it's within driving distance. So if you're on the East Coast, set up Charlotte. I will post the time on the website X Squared Radio. Plus, I will send it out to all my Facebook fans and all my Twitter folks so that you know when it's coming. And I would like to see, you know, at least 10 or 12 people come so that I can afford the venue and feed you and get some stuff like that in place. The other possibility, in addition to the face-to-face seminar we're going to do in Charlotte, is to do an online interactive seminar via Skype. And I can set that up, and that will only cost you $12. So you sign up for that, it's $12. You'll get the entire lecture, which is about 2 hours in that version. And then you'll be able to ask questions from around the world on that, and you can afford it. You can just sit there in your pajamas or your blue jeans with no shirt, no shoes on. No shoes are required. And you can go through the entire lecture that way, and it costs you $12. I think that's totally reasonable considering the content that you're getting and the amount of time it takes me to put it together. So watch for those. Those will be out there. We have about half an hour left in the program. Let's go ahead and take a call. Let's see. I think John from Vancouver. Are you there?
Yeah, hi.
Hi. I'm sorry I made you wait so long. How are you doing, my friend?
Pretty good.
This is Vancouver.
The reason I'm calling is I don't even know how to put this together, but I'll just start off. Listening to you over, a certain amount of time, you're both a scientist and you're into spirituality, which is unusual, and you're, putting those two together.
Well, I think they were once together. I think we just separated them through the guise of religion. And I appreciate the fact that you called it science and spirituality and not science and religion, because I'm definitely not a religionist, even though I've studied many religions in the seminary. But I appreciate that very much. Is there anything in particular that you think about when you think about those two?
Well, there is. I'm just having trouble putting this together. Okay, we'll start with the spiritual side of things. Now, I don't know if you agree with this, but, spirituality, as it's come down to my understanding, is there's one phrase that is really strong within, if you want to call it, New Age spirituality, and that would be, you create your own reality. Now, I don't know if you subscribe to that or not.
Well, it's not as easy as saying that. And I've heard that before. You know, you create your own neighborhood. You create your own reality. And there are, I'm going to call them gurus that are out there that have built nice followings and nice, I'm going to call them congregations around themselves by doing that. But it's a little misleading because in the sense that, yes, there are 7 billion realities on the Earth, but mathematically, all those realities combine to make an average reality. That's why you don't have to believe that there's a chair in the furniture store that some guy made in South Carolina. The average reality is he had a reality that he designed the chair, and that reality continued on into other people's realities. So we have an average reality. We have roads, and we have weather, and we have, you know, iPads that go around the world, and that's the average reality. But the individual reality, how we fit into it, what our consciousness contributes to the formula, is very, very real. And individually, depending on if we're Jesus or if we're one of the sheeple out there, it can have very, very powerful effects. In fact, every single time there are sweeping changes in any society or government, it always starts with a small group. It always starts with 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or a dozen strong consciousnesses that get together and change the mean reality. So in that sense, yes, we can create reality within the bounds of the average reality. Now, obviously, we have a very large population here, John, and we have 7 billion people on the Earth. And with very large populations, it's hard to change the average. But it is possible through mass awakenness, as long as it's not really vague, like you create your own reality. That's a little bit like being handed the big end of the bat and told to go to the plate and hit a home run. You got all the right tools. You're just using them wrong.
Okay. What I'm getting at is, like, if you as the scientist talk about CMEs or asteroids coming in or a planet or that kind of thing, it's like we listen to what might be the inevitable, and so all 7 billion people are you know, if we get hit by a planet like Nibiru or something, we're all going to be wiped out. And so there's a total idea of, you know, humanity being victimized 100%. And that's what bothers me when I hear stuff like that.
Well, I'm thinking, see where that would be bothersome, but you got to think of it like this. And this is where you can relieve the stress of worrying about, is NASA going to tell us about some asteroid the size of Tucson that's hiding out there in the corona of the sun, and they know it's going to hit, but and they're telling all their people to get ready, but they're not telling the masses. So, you know, there's that. But the other is that we are actually a combination of two forms of energy. One is the temporal energy that makes up our physical body, you know, the peas and carrots that make up our biological transducer. And the other is the animated spiritual being within. That cannot be destroyed. Even if this planet is destroyed, you can go to another planet and incarnate there. I know this. I don't believe it. I know it.
Okay, you know what, I don't, so... still, though, you know, writing a prescription for the fate of 7 billion people seems not right to me.
Well, it is not a prescription, it's a process. All I'm telling people, and all I'm trying to awaken them to the fact is, that you need to dream about process and not objects, not solids. If you dream about what you can be and what you can do, inevitably what will happen is, of course, you're going to have things as a result of your actions. But the vast majority of the world, and increasingly so, is concentrated on the having. And they don't care about the being and the doing. They've got it all backwards. And
yeah,
maybe we have had several human zeniths on this planet. And we got screwed up those times, too. We were all about the having and not about the being and the doing, and we were knocked back down to a smaller gene pool, as it were. I think we can supersede that. I think we can evolve past that. I believe that we can. That I don't know, but I do believe it. I believe we've been to this precipice before as a race, and we have walked off. We have destroyed the best and brightest of this race back down to the point where we're riding donkeys and rubbing two sticks together to make fire. Now we're back. And I think, John, we can make the right decision this time.
Well, it kind of reminds me of a concept of, collectively, it was decided that we'd press a button and all of our accomplishments, all of our knowledge was completely wiped out, so we had to start over. And I think we're coming up to a similar point where, we might decide to press that button again, and I sure as hell hope not, but to me like we're coming close to that.
Like the human race needs another Control-Alt-Delete event. I don't think we need to reset and go back to 500,000 people on the earth and grow again. We've been through that.
No, I don't either.
I think we're...
Although, it's so crazy out there right now that I think that might be up for discussion as to whether or not that's on the table. I definitely think that's going to be discussed, but I'm with you, and it's not necessary, and I wouldn't choose that one.
Well, I think it's going to be discussed, but I can tell you right now, as often as I go to Washington, off the record, having lunch with people or speaking in small committee meetings, they know about this. They know about, what I believe and what I know, and it's not that they doubt it. It's they don't know how to implement it. They don't know how to break out of the agency government mold that they're in. I mean, they don't want to lose their job. They don't want any other agency to lose their job. That's kind of anti-government to them. But at the same time, we cannot perpetuate what we are doing now. What was started 80 years ago in 1932 cannot be perpetuated anymore. It has to end. We've got to cut the agency government loose. We've got to return to being a republic.
Well, also, Dr. Agnew, we're dealing with an environment where, you're talking... massive amounts of radiation coming out of Japan. You're talking massive amounts of oil flooding into the Gulf. So I would say the world that we knew doesn't exist anymore. And we're talking about moving into a very much more toxic environment and to a point where what we know about our bodies, it likely... we couldn't handle it with what we know. So if we're going to survive, it's going to involve a level of knowledge where it's not going to bother us. In fact, the environment will be so different, we will have to kind of learn how to consume it.
You bring up a very good point. Very good. I was listening to one of the popular conservative radio hosts this week, and he was livid. He was at the top of his lungs talking about how man has no effect on climate change, no effect on the environment of the planet, that we're insignificant, that we have any right to be here and to do what we're doing as any natural being would. We're part of the ecosystem and our activities, the world just needs to adapt to it. And, of course, I couldn't get through to his phone lines. It's impossible. You have to call on Monday to get in on Wednesday. But my energy that I was sending back to him is you're absolutely in a complete state of denial, because you are right, John. The radiation that's being put off by Fukushima is massive, and when it comes to toxic waste, we have a motto. It's called the solution is dilution. When we have to dump stuff down the sewer, we have to adjust our wastewater to within certain parameters, and then we can dump it down the sewer. The rest of the stuff we have to take to the landfill. With radiation, and I'm going to talk about chronic, long-term decay radiation, like is coming out of Fukushima. You're talking about cesium, and you're talking about low-grade plutonium and enriched uranium. These have anywhere from 12.5-year to 12,500-year decay times. This isn't acute radiation. This is chronic radiation, which means you are exposed to a low dose over a long period of time, and it will absolutely change the biological balance of this planet. From the smallest microorganisms to us, there will be more leukemia, there will be more mutations, there will be more cancers. That's just academic. And I really don't see any end in sight because Fukushima is still leaking. They do not have it cleaned up. They will not have it cleaned up in this decade.
Well, that's what I tell friends of mine, not very often because it's like bad news. As far as I can tell, we need a level of intelligence within our bodies to be able to use radiation as food. Otherwise, I don't see survival for the human race.
Well, I think by and large we do use radiation sensibly. My first degree is in nuclear chemistry, so my professor was Dr. Enzor. He was part of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. He was part of the second response team that went to Chernobyl to survey what happened in that event. So, you know, I have some knowledge of the industry. I'm not speaking as an enthusiast. I'm speaking as a graduate in that science. I can tell you that by and large, we are very responsible when it comes to radiation from a civilian point of view. From a military point of view, we've been absolutely beyond the pale as far as negligent. We've blown up thousands of nuclear weapons. So is China, so is Russia, so is India, so is Pakistan. Unbelievable amount. I mean, I have it on very good authority that India, as we speak, is gearing themselves up on a defensive posture to go to war with China and Pakistan at the same time. That's a country of 2 billion people, and the Indians have never lost a war. In recorded history, it's never happened. Oh, they've been occupied, but they've never lost a war. They're extremely intelligent, and they don't treat death the same way we treat death. They're not afraid of it. Mutually assured destruction won't work with them. But listen, John, I really appreciate the call. I love the subject matter. I got one more caller on the line I want to get to. I always love hearing from you.
All right. Bye for now.
All right. Thanks, John. That was John from Vancouver Island, always a very intelligent contributor to the program, and I'm so glad that he called. All right, let's go ahead and pick up Roland on line one. How are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing, Brooke?
I'm doing excellent. What's on your mind?
I have a quick question. What do you think of the Cape Canaveral thing?
Oh, be specific. Cape Canaveral.
Where they tested the launch with SpaceX and it didn't get off the pad last week.
Yeah, I think there was a problem with one of the regulators. They were having some
pressure. Right, they aborted the mission.
The what?
They aborted the mission.
Yeah, they aborted the – I think they postponed it. I did read a little bit about that. Having some fuel regulator problems. I think
launched. So you think they'll launch it on Tuesday like they planned?
Yeah, I think so. It was a minor problem. It could have been a transducer. It was giving them a false reading. It could have been a leak. But it's not a condition that you would want to waive and launch anyway. So I think they need a success launch. It'll be good for the company. Elon Musk's, you know, certainly excited about it. There are a couple of celebrities on this voyage. It'll be really, I think, a threshold for tourist traffic in space. Yes, it's expensive now, but hey, it's never been done before. So for that, I applaud them.
I mean, the only one that's gone up there, I think, was what? Private citizen was Tito with the Russians.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, he just...
So maybe now the U.S. can put somebody up there as a tourist, which would be kind of nice.
Well, as it turned out, that guy was also an engineer. He went and trained for the mission, and he actually contributed. He wasn't, you know, just a tourist looking out the window snapping pictures with his iPhone. He was part of the mission.
I'm well aware of what he was. I bid a gate at his house over in Palisades, in the Palisades area of Los Angeles.
Yeah, I know the area very well.
Yeah, he's got an outrageous home up there they built. And the guy is a definite engineer, no doubt.
Well, I mean, somebody asked me where I go, and I would say, look, I'm already gone. If the opportunity comes, I want to see Earth from space. It would be very neat.
Well, I'll tell you what, it should be nice to see it work, because then it would put people back to work, because all of a sudden people would get excited about something.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of commercial aspects about space, and we've talked about a bunch of them this year. Not only ridding orbit of space junk, which I think is a marvelous salvage idea, but the moon is wide open. I mean, there's tremendous mineral deposits on the moon. You got oxygen, you got water, you got some natural underground facilities that are post-volcanic that would make wonderful shelters. Yeah, they're underground, but at least you'd be out of the way of solar radiation and small meteorites and things like that, and you'd be at 1/6 gravity, which will allow you to do a lot of things you can't do here on this Earth, and you'd be a good station for heavy lift stations for large orbiting things around other planets.
It'd be really nice to see them do something with the space program again. It's been dead for so long.
Wouldn't it? I think that we need a change in leadership. Because the current leadership we have thinks that the space program is a nice, low-cost novelty. And the commercial aspect. Oh, I'm telling you, Roland, we're behind on our GPS satellite replacement. We're about 8 years behind on that. We've got GPS satellites getting ready to fail. We have weather satellites. Over 40% of them are antiquated and are going to fail any day.
Right.
Some of them fall out of orbit. I mean, we're going to be blind in 10 years if we don't get on the stick here.
Right. We've got to get something done, and we've got to do something that's productive.
And then there's the really important stuff. You know, you got HBO and all that out there. Those satellites are...
Hey, you got to keep the HBO going and the Dish Network, and otherwise what will people have to do at night?
One of my high school buddies, Gino, just bought the Iridium satellite. And he has now created a new cell phone network, which is low cost. He's got a whole new idea for getting those plans out there. And he put, I don't know, $10 or $20 million into it, maybe more. He's got some good, strong investors. He's a smart guy. I went to school with him. And he's doing great things with that Iridium satellite. You know, it went bankrupt, but it was still functional. So he bought it out of bankruptcy, put it back into service.
Nice. Smart guy.
Yeah, and there's tons of stuff that the private sector can be doing, and I don't mean just American, I mean international, that doesn't have anything to do with military applications. And I think it's awesome. I think we should go for it with you know, both hands flying.
I think we better go for it. If we don't get something going, we're going to be in trouble, like you said, in about 10 years.
Yep. Well, then it's going to be catch-up time. Then we're going to be back in crisis mode. And wouldn't you know it, that's probably going to be just about the time when we really do have to have a national budget for defense. I mean, we don't need to defend ourselves against anybody now. We can take that money, as long as we don't spend it in the general fund with stupid social programs, put it into something that would generate a lot of high-level jobs for engineers, inventors, for disruptive energy technologies. It would be awesome.
That would be very awesome, because when I was a kid here in the San Fernando Valley where I live, all the people around us who lived in the neighborhood, all the older people, they were all engineers for the most part because of the space program and the rocket diet for Rockwell International. All that's faded out here. So now they only have service business and rest homes and, you know, everybody wants to sit home and watch TV. Nobody wants to do anything. So, yeah, but I see somebody put people back into a field where they think there is a future.
It would be great.
Sitting at home. Yeah. I mean, otherwise, they go to the bars, they drink, they go home, watch TV, go to sleep, and get up and go to work in the morning.
Life.
Not the healthiest lifestyle.
One of my...
anyway, I just wanted to hear what your take was. I think I agree with you 100%. You know, I think if they can get the space program back into gear, it'd be great.
I think we should do it on an international basis. You know, there's a lot of defense budgets that need to be ground up and made into plows, so to speak.
Right.
Stop defending yourself against everybody else. We're all in this together, and let's turn our eyes skyward.
Right. Start doing something productive. You have my vote. When are you running?
All right.
No, when are you running? I'll vote for you.
Politics, I don't know. Government, I'm into. Politics, no. I'll support candidates. I can do a lot as John Q. Public, but I'm not a public servant. I'm a scientist and engineer, and I do best out here on the ground. But I am going to be...
I think it's great. Well, Brett, just keep it up, because I think you're doing great.
Well, I appreciate it, sir. Thank you so much for calling in. You're a big help.
Thank you. You have a good weekend.
You too. Have a great week.
Thanks. You too. Bye.
One of my other writers, one of my other listeners in another country, has written me and asked me if I have thoughts on the word apocalypse. And, you know, we've done some thinking about the word apocalypse. It is a Greek word. As my good friend Ted says, it means lifting of the veil or revelation. It's a disclosure of something hidden from the majority of mankind in an era dominated by falsehood and misconception. For example, the veil to be lifted. The Apocalypse of John is the book of Revelation, the last book of the New Testament, not in chronological order, but just in the way that King James printed it. By extension, apocalypse can refer to any end time scenario or to the end of the world in general. Well, I guess traditionally in my life been kind of afraid of the word apocalypse just because of that last sentence. Apocalypse always made me think about what the world looks like after the explosions have simmered down. And what I would like to do is try to awaken people to the idea that the whole function of killing people and breaking things is not productive. You know, now that being said, I've certainly seen my share of TV documentary productions where American servicemen have been shot down in their helicopters and they've sat on top of their helicopters and defended themselves against advancing enemies. And shooting one after the other, and living to tell about it. Or, you know, about Navy SEALs going into other countries and taking out particularly bad people in a clandestine manner without a lot of collateral damage. I understand all that. I understand, you know, motorcyclists riding by, sticking a magnetic bomb to something and or a car and blowing up the one guy that could spell the end of the world as they know it. I understand that. But the fear that is built between those leaders that is then instilled in their people to develop that hatred on a national scale, decade after decade, millennia after millennia, to where it becomes a way of life, it becomes a cultural force. You know, we used to think that cats and dogs fight. Well, they don't. I mean, every household I go to has cats and dogs, and they get along just fine. They just do. Now, birds and cats, well, that's maybe, you know, a different story because, you know, birds are food, but cats aren't really food for dogs. They're just traditional enemies. But if you raise them together, if you teach them to tolerate one another, teach them about the beautiful, wonderful things about one another and bring those things out, they won't fight. They won't fight unless their parents teach them the prejudices that, you know, make them fight. But we could stop that in a single generation. We could stop that with awareness. We could stop it with leadership that could step forward and tell a new story, a story of togetherness, a story of a single human race on the planet that just happens to speak different languages, happens to have different creeds, different skin color, different dietary habits, all of that. We've got all that capability, but we do not have the leadership to make that happen. We've tried to do it economically. We've created massive international currencies and forced economies into it. And some have benefited greatly, and most have not. We've tried to do it from a trade point of view, where larger countries dominate the trade of certain commodities, whether it's oil or rice or wheat or weapons. But I think that's the wrong approach. I think it needs to be approached from a cultural point of view. You know, when I go to my Indian friends and I eat at their restaurant, the Spice Restaurant in Charlotte, if you ever have a chance to get to Charlotte, don't forget to eat at the Spice Restaurant. There are four locations. It is the best Indian food in the world. And I haven't been to India yet, so I'm just saying that from my point of view. It's awesome. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I love their music. I love the art. I love the history. I love the dignity and the pride and the tremendous amount of prudence in their society. It's great. I love the Hispanics and their love for family and their closeness to their children, to their religion, and their respect for God and their patience with time and with service and hard work. All of the people, all cultures have redeeming qualities. If we could concentrate on those, if we could learn to live with one another that way, if we could look for the good in one another and bring it out, if we could serve one another in that respect, we wouldn't need jets. We don't need aircraft carriers. We don't need intercontinental ballistic missiles or defense systems because we're not going to fight anymore. But we need leadership that can do that. And I don't mean religious leadership like the Pope standing up and saying, war is bad, war is bad, don't do any war. Nobody listens to that. We need presidents. We need prime ministers. We need kings and queens who can say, that's enough, people. We can talk instantly. We don't have to hide anything from anybody. Let's bury the hatchet. Let's become the race that we were born to be, that we were destined to be. Let's walk away from the precipice of the end of the human race. We can do this. And maybe we can do it right here on this program. So we'll talk about that and more next week right here on X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for being part of the program. We'll see you next week right here. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.